Welcome to the U.S. Institute of Peace, and I'd like to welcome Gabriel Wyman and Dr. Bruce Hoffman and our President, Ambassador Solomon.
Thank you, Kay. Well, we're delighted to have you all here this morning for what I know is going to be a very lively and terrifying presentation. And as you all know, we're here to celebrate the publication of Gabby Wyman's book, Terror on the Internet, The New Arena, The New Challenges. We'll turn the lights off so when he shows his slides, you'll be able to see them very clearly. Let me give you just a little background on the Institute's interest in Gabby Wyman's work. It was only a short dozen years ago, not long after I came here, that Bob Schmidt, who was our information technologies manager, who was at that time worrying about getting fax machines and computers to enable you to type up your work, said, hey, there's something called the Internet that you ought to start paying attention to. Now, from earlier times, I was aware of the ARPANET, which was the progenitor of the Internet, so it wasn't totally a surprise to me, but it was very clear as we followed up on Bob Schmidt's urgings that it was clear that the Internet was going to be a change agent technology and one that held all sorts of positive implications for bringing about what we viewed as positive social change. It was an integrating and aggregating technology, one that would give voice to new political communities, irrespective of their geographical dispersion. One of the early uses that, given earlier work I'd done on the Cambodia peace settlement, was Prince Sihanouk set up a website that brought together the Khmer diaspora around the world, and of course now they're multitude of such community websites. But as we learned also, it was going to have a very powerful political impact, and I think the first use of the Internet to mobilize a global community on a fairly esoteric issue was Jody Williams up in Canada, an anti-landmine activist who created a political movement that successfully changed government policies by building a worldwide movement against landmines. So these new possibilities began to become quite visible in the 1990s and led us to create a project that we have called, continue to call, virtual diplomacy. Others call it digital diplomacy. You could use a word other than diplomacy. You could talk about politics, but we can talk some other time about what might be a more effective name. And Bob Schmidt and then Cheryl Brown and Margarita Studemeister, all here, did some extremely important work on looking at how these new technologies could contribute to the management of political circumstances and crisis management. 1994, we ran a major conference, Managing Global Chaos, and in that context, we tried to highlight the value of these technologies for knitting together humanitarian response actors, communities that had not had much experience working together, the military, the NGO communities. It gave them an opportunity to work together electronically in ways that they had not done before. Now, if the Internet was seen as a force for positive change, to use a familiar expression, it also is, there is a dark side to the force, and that's what we're really here to talk about today. Gabby Wyman is a professor of communications at Haifa University, and we shamelessly brought him here to the Institute in 2003 and 4 after about 5 years of research he had done elsewhere to conclude the book that we're going to be talking about today. During his first years of research, he began with about 12 websites that were operated by terrorist organizations. And today that figure now is on the order of 5,000 websites. which is shocking. It shows the dispersal of this kind of political activity, and I know it's something he will talk about. I was just musing to him about what does it say about the education level, the level of technological sophistication of terrorist groups if they're able to use this technology so effectively. And the point he makes is that really it doesn't take much more than a high school education to be able to use an internet related system. But again, we'll get off into that. This area of activity, undoubtedly spurred on by Gabby Wyman's work, will continue to be an area of interest. We've been doing work on terrorism over more than the last decade, and the bringing together of the virtual diplomacy work and the terrorism, counterterrorism work will, again, remain much on our agenda. And it's that in that context, though, I'm very pleased that my old colleague, he's not old, but my RAND colleague, Bruce Hoffman, is with us today. Bruce is one of the stars from the period of RAND. I was fortunate to be heading the political science program. Condi Rice was another member of our group, Frank Fukuyama. RAND has been a progenitor of lots of talent, and Bruce, who now runs RAND's Washington office and heads its corporate chair in counterterrorism and counterinsurgency, is certainly one of those stars, and he's written the foreword to the book that we'll be looking at today. I just might also say that books are available to you all outside the room, and at the end of our session today, I'm sure Gabby will be glad to sign them for you. So we're delighted you're with us, Gabby, Bruce as well, and the floor is yours.
Please.
Yours.
Mine?
Yours. How many comments on you?
Okay.
You're the star.
Good morning. Yeah, it's rather be in the darkness. The dark side of the web. As Dr. Solomon mentioned, when we started, now that was 8 years ago, in 1998, there were 12 websites. In 2003, there were 2,650, and then we published the first research report at USIP. Today, it's even hard to say today, because it was some days ago, there were over 4,800. I bet you today there are even more terrorist websites. The internet became a very active arena, not only for terrorists, but also for those who fight terrorism. As I will argue, and actually the book argues, both sides are, in a way, abusing this medium. Instead of speaking about my book, because I guess the best thing for you would be to read it, I will discuss what are the new trends following the book. What are we finding recently in the few months that passed since this book was written? Just some graphic presentations. Terrorists are always online. And you can see here, in this case, Chechen rebels with the laptop on the side. You can see the Al-Qaeda warriors with the Kalashnikov and a laptop. And by the way, the picture on the laptop is the official website of Al-Qaeda. Who are the terrorists online? You don't have to read the whole list, all of them. All the terrorist organizations have now one form, at least one form, of presence on the net. Most of them have more than one website in more than one language. They do have websites in 6, 8, 10 different languages, targeting different target populations. All of them are using the net in various ways, including, as I will show, chat rooms, forums, electronic billboards, and so on. What are the advantages of the internet for the terrorists? It's very easy to list, and I just go very fast through them. Easy access from everywhere. You can log on and disappear into the darkness 5 seconds later and maintain your anonymity, which in the case of terrorists is a very crucial aspect. It has huge audiences, worldwide. I'll show you some figures in a moment. Especially among young people, the young generation. There's no way you can regulate it. There's no way you can stop terrorists from using it, and we'll discuss it at the end of my presentation. It's very fast. Within seconds, the news, the pictures, the videos will flow everywhere. Very important, and it's an interactive medium. You can interact with your audiences. You can talk to the people asking questions, looking for directions, communicating with you. Relatively cheap to establish and maintain, unlike conventional medium like television or radio. It's a multimedia environment, I'll show you in a minute. And it's an important source of information for journalists, for the conventional media. It fits the conventional media too. About internet penetration, one may say, well, this is usually perceived to be the medium of the West, of the advanced society, of the educated, of the liberal societies. Well, not really. I mean, this argument goes well with the right column, the word users. We're a little bit slicing it, but the penetration is really highest among Western societies. Nevertheless, if you look at the growth, the middle column, in the last 5 years, or 2000 to 2005, you'll find that the highest rates of penetration are in the third world. The third world is catching up. The internet becomes the medium of the world, not only of Western societies. How do they use it, terrorists? Well, the book gives examples of all these purposes, and I will not discuss them right now, from psychological warfare to propaganda, the way they communicate with each other. They don't use the telephone anymore, certainly not meetings face-to-face. The old camps are replaced by virtual training. They recruit and mobilize people on the net. They direct them. They raise funds. They look for information, data mining on the net. They send instructions, booklets. And they even conduct, which I will discuss later, their own debates online. I would like to focus in this short presentation only on the recent trends, the post-book, if you want, trends. First one will be narrowcasting. When we use the word broadcasting, we mean looking for the broadest potential audience. Indeed, the first websites of terrorists were broadcasting style. They tried to target huge audiences with the same website, with the same style, with the same rhetoric. Recently, what we note is a trend to more sophisticated type of slicing the target audiences into small, specific subpopulations and targeting them with a narrowcasting type of websites. So they have specific and special websites designed for special subpopulations. Let me give you some examples. The first one, and a scary one, and you were right, Dr. Solomon, this is not going to be a happy lecture in a way. The first one is targeting children on the net. They know that children are exposed to the internet. They know that the children are the next generation. They know that they can find them, talk to them, convince them, recruit them using the net. So some examples. You have websites like this, designed by Hamas, which is one of the terrorist websites that we monitor. Hamas is active in over 50 different websites, so this is just one of them, designed for children. It's full with comic-style graphics, storytelling, animation. Most of the stories told there are for children. Nevertheless, within those websites, you'll find a picture like this, all of a sudden, of a suicide bomber, female suicide bomber, decapitated body in Jerusalem, and praises for the Shahida, the female suicide bomber, or the will on the same website of a suicide bomber. Hezbollah, another terrorist organization, is using other method. On the web, they have a special website with a game for children. Special force. It looks like, I won't call it innocent, but one of those computer games for children, especially for boys, using the computer as a battlefield. Nevertheless, this is, in fact, a training camp for future terrorists, designed for children, but the game is not innocent. The targets are political. The pictures there are chosen very carefully of specific targets, and you can download it from the net. The Chechens are now posting a website with games for children. Again, not innocent at all. So we have websites, and I'll just go through it, by different Palestinian organizations, by non-Muslims, that are targeting children, posting pictures of children, especially children who committed suicide, or children imitating adult terrorists, as in this case, on the net. Does it have an impact? One of the websites on the net posts Arab children imitating the execution of, in the style of Musa Bazarkawi. Now, if you remember the execution of the late Nicholas Berg, posted on the net, spread within seconds all over the world, and you look at the picture and you see the staging, you see the posting, the posing, you see that these children are imitating what they saw on the net. Narrowcasting is not only for children, it's also for women. Women became a popular target group for internet terrorists. And one of Al-Qaeda's magazines, online magazine, in pink, is targeting women, telling them how to raise children to become suicide bombers, or suicide terrorists, or shahid, how to provide first aid to family members injured in battle, training women to prepare themselves to become suicide terrorists, how to support fighting husbands, and biographies of mujahidit, the female mujahideen. And you have websites that are designed for women, talking to women, presenting women, sending their children with explosive belts on the net. Hamas websites, again, this is a combination of targeting females and children on the net. And again, it starts with a very naive type of cartoon. It's a wide-eyed female who becomes a terrorist. And the text, of course, is not that naive as the first pictures. Another new trend is the synergy. Now, Internet should not be taken or regarded as another medium, as a medium joining the others. It's not one more medium as radio, television. This one is all media in one medium. The Internet has television. You can download films. You can download print. You can listen to the radio. You can post text. You can talk. It's a multimedia environment. Now, terrorists are now grasping this potential and are using it in a more and more sophisticated way. So if you look at this website of Al-Qaeda, this was actually one of the earliest websites of Al-Qaeda in the late 90s, relatively primitive, only one language, only in Arabic, called Al-Nida, the call. And it was maintained there, stayed there until 2002. Nevertheless, it was replaced by numerous websites that are much more sophisticated, that are linked to other websites, to other groups. Al-Qaeda has now a media department on the net. They publish their manuals, in this case, the Voice of Jihad, Sawat al-Jihad, the Voice of Jihad, which is the spiritual manual, the religious one, on the net. And one can download it, print it in colors, and distribute it. Zarqawi has his own manuals online, other groups in Iraq. You can download posters like this. The website of Aleph, that group in Japan that was involved in the spreading of gas, deadly gas in the subways. Hezbollah has a television online, radio online, publishing house online. You can download posters of the leaders from, and this is one of the examples of the most modern versions of a magazine online by the Afghanistan Mujahideen. Al-Qaeda is now running a television station online, on the net, So there's no need for satellites, for antennas. It's all on your computer, accessible to everyone. They even have a university online. Third trend, virtual communities. Terrorists in the past, in the 70s, 80s, 90s, used to meet together, train together. Now they meet in cyberspace. The community is a virtual community. It's a huge community. Now, if you think about movements, I will not even call it an organization like Al-Qaeda, because Al-Qaeda is not a terrorist organization. It's a network of networks. The communities are global. The communities are diaspora communities all over the world. Most of the people involved in Al-Qaeda operations are recruited from these virtual communities, from the diaspora communities. The same was in England, in Spain, or in the 9/11 events. So the internet became the meeting place, the place where they meet, exchange, where they feel that they belong to each other, where they can interact on the net. And just some quotes that reflect this trend. Now, how do they do it? They have chat rooms like this, where you can just log in and talk to your friends who are worldwide supporters of Al-Qaeda. Paradoxically, most of the websites of Al-Qaeda supporters are posted on American websites of Yahoo and other groups. Al-Qaeda has a forum, another forum. So the internet became a very active meeting place for modern terrorists and their supporters and the future terrorists. Fourth trend, really new one, and I just wrote a paper, and Bruce, I think, is the only one who read it already, debates online. Very interesting. There's not only discuss issues on the net and coordinate the actions, they also present the disagreements, the cleavages, the conflicts on the net. They debate on the net. So we can learn a lot, not only about the mindset of the terrorists from following and monitoring those terrorist chat rooms and forums, but also on the things that divide them, on the sources of disagreement. Now, I won't go long into this area, but the virtual disputes on the net can be between organizations, within organizations, between leaders or supporters, personal disputes, or disputes that focus on certain activities, like the London bombings, for example, that created a lot of debate among terrorists and their supporters on the net. Now, it's interesting not only to watch what is debated, but what is not debated, what is agreed upon, or what was once debated and is not debated anymore. Now, this will be the topic of the new publication, new paper, but just some examples. What was once very debated on the net chat of terrorist communities, on the virtual communities, and what is not debated anymore? First of all, the use of suicide attacks. That was once a debated issue. Now it seems like agreed upon. There are many fatwas supporting it. So if anyone raises a question about it, he will get the answer backed up with a lot of fatwas, religious support for that. The use of women and children, that was once debated. And I said, once? It means like 3-4 years ago. And now it's being accepted. The issue of Muslims being victimized, including in September 11, or in London, or in Madrid, or in mass bombings. Debated once, not anymore. And maybe the scariest thing of all is the use of weapons of mass destruction that was once debated and now is not an issue of debate anymore. Five and six, very fast. Iraq became a major issue on the net. It galvanizes the terrorist communities. It links them together. It creates networks of terrorists supporting the same issue, focusing on it. One of the newcomers to the Iraqi issue was Lashkar-e-Toiba in Pakistan, that was mainly involved, feel recently in the Pakistani issue, in the Indian issue, the religious debate or dispute there. After the Iraq war, Lashkar Toiba joined the anti-American campaign, threatening not only, if you see it from the graphics, Capitol Hill on fire, but in the American flag on fire, but also sending volunteers to fight American forces in Iraq. So you have more and more organizations joining in, and you have even, which is really new, the Mujahideen Shura, which is a coalition. You are going to Iraq next week, right? So I hope this won't be your hosts there, but this is the new coalition of about six or seven of the insurgent groups in Iraq. They just sent a press release. Again, everything is done on the internet. The Algerian GSPC associated with the war in Iraq, even arguing or calling in a message on the web for the brothers in Iraq to execute two Algerian diplomats that were captured July 26, 2005. They were executed. GSPC sent thank you note, everything on the net. Well, I won't go into all of them. Finally, virtual training. The internet became a training camp. Now, that was already noted even in the book or before that, but it became more and more sophisticated and more popular. They can't meet as they used in the past in Libya or in Iraq or in Afghanistan or in Syria or in Lebanon. Modern terrorists meet on the internet. They send directions, training books, manuals, practical magazines. Everything is posted on the net. It can be downloaded. It can be learned. It can be applied. Like Al-Batar, the sword, the instruction manual used to be published twice a month on the net by Al-Qaeda. Each issue devoted to different topic, like kidnapping, like bombs, and so on. You have practical instructions, websites on how to use fertilizer to build bombs, how to place the bombs, on poisons, if you want to make, like the white powder that we saw here in Washington, the ricin. Instructions on using Stinger missiles against planes, where to put them, what to direct, what is the direction, what is the distance, everything online. Websites of instructions, and I guess nobody here wants to be a future terrorist, so I'm wasting my time showing you those instructions. Manufacturing explosive belts, all online videos of instructions. Encyclopedia online. Now, in conclusion, not only terrorists are abusing the net. In order to fight terrorism, counter-terrorist agencies worldwide, in democracies like in Europe, North America, Israel, are applying counter-terrorist measures. In a way, some of them are abusing civil liberties, abusing the freedom of the press, freedom of communication, and abusing the internet. So the war on the internet, in a way, very invisible, very unknown, very virtual in a way, became a very wild, I would say, threatening type of conflict. We don't know much about it. We know that somebody is doing something to somebody. What are the prices that we are paying? We know some of the measures are listed here, discussed in the book, but what are the prices that democracies are paying and are willing to pay for the war on terrorism on the net? So, in fact, the last chapter in my book is a proposition, or set of propositions, on how to look for a golden pass, for the golden way, for the minimal damages caused to liberal societies and to our civil liberties, and yet minimize the threats of the internet being used by terrorists. Before concluding, one word of thank you. When I ended up my year here, I was asked, how did you do it? I mean, two research reports, one book, and about 20 scientific publications resulted from this project. How could you do it in one year? And here are my three answers. First one, you have to start 6 years ahead, which I did. You have to work 6-7 days a week, and I spent a lot of weekends in this facility here, enjoying every moment. But I came on weekends too. And most important, the last factor, is the great team of USIP. I'm more than grateful to some of the people that are right now here. First one, who is not here, was my former director, a real mentor, a friend, a colleague, somebody that gave me a lot of support throughout those years. The former director of the fellowship program, Dr. Joe Klaitz, who is not with us here today. Dr. Richard Solomon, who was so supportive during the project and after that. John Christ, my program officer. Where are you, John? An officer and a gentleman. And those who know him know why I say that. Ginny, for all your support. Ginny had to suffer some Hungarian calls from my parents, remember, on the phone. They called the wrong office. To Elizabeth, two who are not here, Elizabeth Drauklich, and Jean. Jean is here, right? Raise your hand. Both of them are. Great. And to my devoted research assistants, I had many all over the years, all over the world, but two of them were my USIP, Rachel, and you're here, right, Rachel? And Alison Talbot, thank you. And finally, to the most important person who is not here, and that's my wife. Thank you.
I'll sit here if that's okay.
Either way.
Okay. I don't have as elegant a PowerPoint presentation or with the graphics that Gabi does. Well, first let me say how delighted I was to have been asked to write the foreword to Gabi's book, and also how honored I am to serve as a discussant. I think it's remarkable that the picture that Gabi paints is a remarkably bleak one, and I think underscores one of the preeminent challenges that we face, not only in countering terrorism, but in the war on terrorism. We repeatedly hear how this is a war, a struggle over minds and over ideas, and yet the story that Gabi tells so effectively and so empirically in his book is that this is very patently a struggle that we're losing, that certainly our adversaries have stolen a tremendous march and are far ahead. And the fact, too, remarkably, how important this issue is. As Gabi points out, there are some 4,800 insurgent or jihadi websites throughout the world. And it's a tribute to Gabi's scholarship that not in the past few months, when many people have turned to the Internet as one of the few years, the Internet as having provided a boon to terrorist propaganda, recruitment, as he points out, not only those things, but also to the conveyance of instructions, the dissemination of training manuals to further terrorism. It's a remarkable triumph that not only has Gabi written, I think, such an incisive and trenchant and timely work, but it's the only one that I know of. I don't know of any other book. This is the first book that is really mining an uncharted waters, one that's absolutely critical. This is Gabi's show, of course, and what I thought I would do, just in a brief few remarks to follow on his work, is to say something about the implications of this development for counterterrorism and for the war on terrorism. And it's easy, actually, to be brief, mainly because, at least in my view, our efforts and countermeasures to date have been lamentably anemic, if non-existent. And that, I think, is one of the other very disturbing messages that Gabi's book depicts, that not only are the terrorists way out in front of us in this mode of communication, but that our efforts, not only to meet, but to effectively counter and even surpass terrorist efforts in this respect, at least on the Internet, from my knowledge, have been woefully inadequate. Now, clearly, we have a host of both public and private agencies, offices, concerns that, much like Gabi, have monitored jihadi insurgent and terrorist messages on the web. Certainly, this is the job of the new Open Source Center, which was formerly the Federal Broadcast Information Service, FIBIS. There are certainly excellent private services like Rita Katz's site, like Memory, many others that monitor the sites. But again, going back to my immediately previous point, what we find is that there's very little effort to counter this. And what's happened, I think, is Gabi magisterially describes in his book is that the internet has become a vacuum that the jihadis and the terrorists have filled. And this is a reflection of their ability to stay ahead of the technology curve, to understand, in fact, our society, to understand the impacts of globalization and of communication, unfortunately, even better than we do. Gabi talked about the fact that Al-Qaeda has a communications department. I think, remarkably, from the time that Al-Qaeda was organized in the late 1980s and early 1990s, from the beginning, it had four departments. One, obviously, to carry out terrorist attacks. One, equally as obviously, to facilitate the logistical requirements to undertake and abet those attacks. A third department that was oriented towards the theological justifications and ideological legitimization of these acts. And then from the start, Al-Qaeda had invested a tremendous amount of effort and attention in creating a communications department, where bin Laden recruited many of the Egyptian jihadis that had fought in Afghanistan in the 1980s, who were computer literate, who were certainly committed to the cause. Way before we were even thinking of this as a mode of communication, Al-Qaeda was, as Gabi describes, was already up on the web with al-Nida.com, disseminating not just propaganda, not just recruitment, but indeed the wherewithal and the means to engage in terrorist attacks. And I'll give you one stunning example of this. In the initial period of the war on terrorism, in the weeks and months following Operation Enduring Freedom, when the United States and its coalition partners invaded Afghanistan, where we completely smashed Al-Qaeda's infrastructure in that country, we uprooted its training camps, its operational bases, destroyed its command and control nexus. Literally, while all those events were unfolding, al-Nida.com was up and running. In addition, Suleiman Abu Ghaith, Al-Qaeda's then chief spokesperson, was distributing in the other ancillary development of this, which Gabi only touched on, but which is also mentioned in his book, is the sale and the circulation of customized, very professionally produced DVDs, VCDs, CD-ROMs. And exactly during this period, as we were running Al-Qaeda to ground, crushing them in Afghanistan, there was Suleiman Abu Ghaith appearing with a video actively recruiting jihadis to come to Pakistan and Afghanistan to come fight against the United States and the coalition partners. Now, of course, you know, a handful of people, a ragtag group of recruits that were converging or that would have converged on Pakistan and Afghanistan at that time, couldn't have done much, if anything, to stem this tide of Operation Enduring Freedom. But the key was, through this ability to communicate, through this ability to publicize themselves, through this ability to wave their hands and say, we're still out here, and not only are we still out here, but we're unbroken, we're still recruiting, was, in Al-Qaeda's terms, an enormous boon to its morale. And it was precisely taking advantage of electronic means of communication, such as this. To a large extent, I think, to date, we've ceded this virtual battlefield. And that, as successful as the war on terrorism has been on the actual physical battlefield, here when the president proudly and rightly points to the 75% of Al-Qaeda's senior leadership that's been killed and captured, the 4,000 Al-Qaeda operatives that our allies have killed or captured throughout the world. These are very important, very significant advances, but they will be to naught if we are not successful in contesting this virtual battlefield as well. And here, really, I think our efforts are skewed. Somewhat belatedly, but I think nonetheless salutary development, we've been focusing of late more attention to what's generically called public diplomacy or information operations. We've created the TV station Al Hura, the radio station Ashsawa, the Voice of America, I believe, is now broadcasting on 9 different Arabic language channels. All these things are enormously positive step forwards. But unfortunately, it's operating from a mindset that one size fits all, that there's this vast Muslim community out there that the same message can be effectively communicated to through the same media or through traditional media. And this assumes that everyone out there is getting all their news and all their information from this traditional media, from TV, from radio, from newspapers. But what Gabi's work, I think, very eloquently and indisputably underscores is that there's a raft of people out there, not necessarily large in number, but nonetheless influential, who aren't getting their news from TV or radio or the newspapers, but are getting all their news from the internet. and all their news from these websites, which has enormous consequences, because just as Gabi pointed out with the emergence of the voice of the caliphate, Al-Qaeda's online TV news show, is we see a parallel truth emerging that's contesting the truth and knowledge that the mainstream media is, at least we hope, disseminate. And this underscores, I think, an enormous problem with the Internet, is that when the Internet first emerged, we conceived of it, I think optimistically, and not necessarily incorrectly, but certainly hopefully, as this vast engine of enlightenment and education. But as Gabi's work points out, a segment of international society, of global society, has hijacked the Internet and has turned it into a vehicle for the purveying of some of the most coarse and base conspiracy theories that appear with a ubiquity and a pervasiveness that now have assumed an aura of truth rather than what is true. And this is the problem. We tend to see the main challenge in the struggle for hearts and minds as coming from traditional media like the Al Jazeera TV station, for example, that's often singled out as quote-unquote the problem. That shows how far behind the curve we are. For many of these radicals, Al Jazeera is seen as mainstream. After all, it's based in Qatar. The Emir of Qatar is one of our closest allies. CENTCOM is based there. They're well past that. They're not tuning into Al Jazeera. If they're looking at any news, and Gabi briefly touched on this, but he mentions it at greater length in his book, if they're looking at any news, it's Al-Manar, the beacon, Hezbollah's TV station. So now we have a terrorist group that has 24/7 satellite radio and TV stations. But in addition to that, we have these websites that are, as I said, communicating and purveying falsehoods that have become a parallel truth strictly because of their ubiquity and because of their pervasiveness. So in this respect, our efforts to challenge this, when they do start, will inevitably be from a position of weakness, from having to catch up, from having ignored the emergence of the Internet as a means of radicalization. I would say that in many authorities, I'm not sure that there's necessarily yet, although I'm sure eventually we'll see it, a direct linear connection between the Internet and actual recruitment. But I have to say, I've been an expert witness in a number of terrorist cases in Europe involving terrorists there from the Islamic terrorists there from those countries. And I've had access to the hard drives and the emails of these terrorists. Now, I won't claim that one can look within a terrorist's soul by looking at their hard drive or their email, but you certainly can look within their mindset. And this isn't a scientific study, but at least in the handful of cases where I've had this access, everything that Gabi talks about is absolutely right. One sees, and this is not an editorial comment by any stretch of the imagination on Iraq, but one sees Iraq as an important fulminate that's constantly communicated through the Internet. The fundamental messages of a predatory, aggressive West with the United States at its head, waging an aggressive campaign against Islam, of Islam on the defensive, of the need to defend the Ummah against these depredations, against this aggressiveness. These are the persistent themes that not only are struck on the Internet, but then are honed, then are sharpened, and then are very visually arresting, communicated through JPEGs, through very visually effective sites, through interactive, as Gabi has described, means, and also in many instances in real time. We see in Iraq, for example, a phenomena where vehicular suicide attacks of late have tended to involve three vehicles, one vehicle with the suicide bomber, another vehicle with the handler or guide or someone who might have a remote control means to detonate the device should the suicide bomber get cold feet, and then a third vehicle with a video team that's capturing the footage and posting it online. So you have a situation now where virtually every insurgent group, as Gabi described, including Zarqawi's, has their own website. They're broadcasting, not quite in real time, but often pretty close, and they're deliberately attempting not just to counter, but to supplant the established wire services and news agencies, whether it's BBC.co or CNN.com or UPI or AP and so on. Gabi also points out that it's not just a matter of websites, but it's also the problem of forums. And here, I think, is another untapped area that we're far behind the curve. Recently, there was a very good article in USA Today by a woman named Cassie Hunt that was as chilling as Gabi's work. And in it, she described how Orkut, which is the Google version of Facebook or My Friends or Friendster — I'm too old to know all these things, this is what my kids hang out on, but in any event, I was invited to join ORCUT as well. I had learned before the article was published from the journalist about this, and it was absolutely remarkable. There's a Bin Laden user-friendly group, or a Bin Laden buddies list, that has more than 2,000 people. And the purpose of this buddies list is not necessarily hardcore terrorist recruitment and radicalization, though that's certainly one of, I think, the processes it can serve, because what this buddies group or buddies list is oriented towards is to extol the virtues of Osama bin Laden. And how he has been the David that's challenged the Goliath, that has stood up for the comment. I mean, basically, it's building support for one of the 21st century's greatest mass murderers, which is not just obscene, but almost unimaginable. So the problem is not just the internet sites, but it's also the accretion, the spread of electronic means of communication to chat rooms, to electronic forums, to bulletin boards, and then the whole process of disseminating this material in very professionally produced, sophisticated CD-ROMs, VCDs, and so on. We're also the same training manuals. In fact, what we see already coming from Iraq is lessons learned from the jihadis there, how to stage roadside improvised explosive devices. I've recently saw a DVD that provided instructions to use standoff remote control mortars to attack distant targets. Well, what do we do about it? I think first and foremost, we have to understand that waging this war for ideas isn't something that we can just rely on traditional media. That as important as all those things are, and I don't want to denigrate at all the significance of Al-Hurra, Sawar, the Voice of America, and so on. That's just one element. Those are just one sets of tools. Those are perhaps most effective in preventing, one hopes, or stopping moderates from becoming radical, because the moderates arguably are still getting their news from these traditional media sources. We have to be equally effective at finding a way to stop the radicals from becoming violent. And if the radicals have already transcended these traditional media and are getting all their news and information on the web, we have to be more effective on the web. So therefore, our public diplomacy and our information operations have to play on this virtual battlefield just as actively and just as successfully as they have played on the physical battlefield. We also have to build capacity amongst our allies, amongst moderate governments, amongst NGOs, and so on. As I said, the picture that Gabby paints is bleak in a number of areas. Firstly, the professionalism of the people using the web. Secondly, their technological expertise. Thirdly, the fact that they've been able to fill a vacuum and steal a march on us. But it's also the sheer ubiquity of these sites. If you want information on the war on jihad, on the jihadi struggle, it's arguably far easier to get them from the 4,800 sites that, as I said, are all visually arresting, very well designed, have often real-life information, certainly very compelling footage and images, however heinous, of course, and completely macabre and distasteful they might be. But they dominate the internet. What we have to do is help our allies. It's not only something we need to do, but we have to help our allies and build capacity, not only to counter terrorism in the traditional senses, improving their law enforcement, their intelligence gathering, legislative advice, and so on, but also help them fundamentally in this critical arena. And I'll give you an example. Go to the websites of any of the countries that are some of our staunchest allies in the Middle East and look at their sites. Firstly, if you do a Google search, and I'm speaking just in English now, the first hit you're going to get isn't the site of the government of, and you can substitute Egypt, Jordan, Yemen, any other country. Often the first hit you get is the CIA fact book, which will tell you about that government. Then when you drill down deeper, in some instances you can relatively easily, but not quite straightforward, find the websites, whether in English or in Arabic. But these sites are typically what you would expect. They're not as developed. They're seeing, they're presenting information through the prism of that government. They're not understanding the adversary and presenting the information in a way that firstly will specifically and deliberately counter the message of the jihadis, of their enemies. But rather, they're presenting information that's really akin to sort of an elementary school civics course. It's all the basic information. So this is where I think we have to invest greater resources and greater attention if we're going to be successful in the war on terrorism, and especially if we're going to be successful in the war on terrorism, not just in neutralizing the threat that exists from the current generation of terrorists, those who are already radicalized, who are already trained, who are armed and equipped and confront us throughout the world today. But this kind of investment will enable us to counter forget about the present generation, but the next generation, the people who are being radicalized now, who are backfilling the ranks of the terrorist and insurgent groups throughout the world. This type of investment will pay off dividends not just for the next generation, but for even the generation beyond the next one, for the children throughout the Muslim world, throughout North Africa, the Middle East, and South Asia, who are coming of age in an era not just of unrivaled and unmitigated bloodshed in many instances, but of radicalization, of polarization, of intolerance. So this, I would argue, is going to be the real future battlefield. And this is why Gabi Weiman's book is so enormously important and so timely a publication. Thank you very much.
Gabi and Bruce, thank you. This is chilling, but also extremely important and exceptionally enlightening presentation. We will now go to Q&A. I only have one request, Gabi. I'm a little nervous about this big sign over here called the end. This ought to be the beginning of a new phase of our look at this. But
would you like this better?
If the floor is open, if you will please come to the microphone here so we can get you on tape, and so our audience will hear your question. Please identify yourself by name and your organizational affiliation and address your question to one of our presenters. Please.
My name is Omar Al-Ghazi. I'm a Fulbright scholar at American University. You mentioned that one size doesn't fit all when you said about the American efforts to address different Muslim societies. But don't you think that also when we talk about terrorists, we shouldn't lump them all together in one category? For example, like in your presentation, did you consider in the book different categories for different terrorist groups? Like some groups only have the internet as form of public space. Others are represented in parliament and are even in government. So the internet is not their main source of interaction. Also, you said, for example, Al-Manar was mentioned as promoting terrorism. But actually, even if you like, Al-Manar is very critical of terrorism in Iraq and defends Shiites in Iraq. So there's also this dynamic between Shiite and Sunni. And also, there's a for Hezbollah, for example, it is controversial if it's a terrorist group or not, because it is not considered by the EU to be terrorist. And there's this other, definition of terrorism question. Basically, this is my question. I just also have a comment. You used when you were in your presentation, you used the term shaheed as a synonym of terrorist. And the word, like you said, shaheed or terrorist, the term in Arabic for suicide bomber is istishhadi and not shaheed. Shaheed is martyr, okay, who are victims of violence. Thank you.
Two answers?
Yeah.
Good questions. Usually we are asked when we study terrorism, who is a terrorist? And I have at least 164 answers, because there are 164 definitions for terrorism right now in the literature. And, of course, most of the definitions are biased by the people who define terrorism. So the only way to deal with it is to accept the most widely accepted definition, which is done by the State Department. The State Department in the U.S. is publishing a list of terrorists designated as terrorist organizations, using a definition based on those 164 definitions and actually looking for the common elements. So I'm not defining terrorism. I'm not choosing selective groups to be studied. All this that are designated as terrorist groups are in my list, in my study, including a Jewish underground organization, the Kach Kahana movement, with three websites. Categories in terrorism, of course. When you study dozens of terrorist organizations, they are certainly not the same. And differences within organizations, over time, across media, and so on. So if you look at the book, you'll see that we devoted some of the chapters to the study of specific groups. What are the media strategies they use? What are the type of internet presence? What is the rhetoric they use? How do they justify the use of violence, for example, which is a real challenge for most terrorist organizations? Are there differences between them, you ask? Certainly there are. If only because some of them are latecomers to the arena, learning how to use the medium, the new medium. Some of them have been there for 10 years now, 8 years. There are differences because they are not using the same rhetoric. They are not motivated by the same motive. Mind you, we are not studying only Islamist jihadist movements. You mentioned memory or sight. They are more focused on certain groups. We study all of them, religious or non-religious. Marxist, Muslim, Jewish, Christian organizations, all of them. And there are differences, of course, which I couldn't just describe in those few moments of this of presentation. Finally, about rhetoric. It's not just the use of words shaheed as martyr. Of course, they use the word shaheed to describe suicide to terrorism because it makes the act a religious, sacred one, something that you can sympathize with. Now, I will not go into details, but one of the chapters in the book discusses the issue of displacement of responsibility. How do terrorists disassociate themselves from the actions, the violent actions they do? And instead of going into many explanations, just one example. Dehumanization of the targets, of the action, is one of the tactics that social psychologists will suggest as the best mean to present your act not as a terrorist one, but more as a humanistic one. If you look at the websites of Al-Qaeda, when they describe September 11, there's one thing they never mention, the number of victims. Never. It's regarded and presented as an attack on symbols, symbols of wealth, of American power, and so on buildings, on the pride of America. The victims are not mentioned, not the number. So there are many ways, and I'm coming from the communication perspective, to study terrorist websites and the rhetoric, and of course the names they use have meanings and are chosen very carefully to present a special type of argument.
Well, these are two, I think, very good questions or points that were raised. I mean, one, the perennial issue that is that has often been the focus of much debate is what is a terrorist or what is terrorism, and who should have that label. And actually, again, I have to pay tribute to you in your book because you have a very lengthy discussion of how absolutely effective the Internet is in muddying this particular area as well, and rather than enlightening people, only confuses these more. And actually, Hezbollah is among the groups that's an example of what Gabi describes in his book of information laundering, where the groups have very effectively used the web to portray themselves in the most positive light possible. Just as you said that on the Al-Nida.webcom website, there's no mention of the 3,000 victims. I mean, many of the times when you look at these terrorist websites, what one finds is that, you know, you have to kind of pinch yourself to realize that it's actually a terrorist group because you learn, as in the case of Hezbollah, of their many good deeds, of their social welfare activities, of the assistance that they provide to seriously injured former members who require rehabilitation, the support that they provide to the wives and orphans of whether they're suicide terrorists or other martyrs. Many of these sites, as Gabi also describes, have poetry, have profiles of the leaders, but really very little to do with terrorism. So thus our understanding of who is or who isn't a terrorism isn't edified or isn't often advanced by these websites, but the terrorists have been very effective in seizing on this tool or this technique to further obfuscate exactly those titles. I mean, in my view, I think it's clear a group can surrender rightly the moniker of being a terrorist when they're like the Provisional Irish Republican Army and they not only eschew the use of violence and pledge to support the political process, but surrender or decommission their arms. That's something Hezbollah hasn't done. Or perhaps when they at least attempt to enter into the political process once again and to forswear violence like ETA has recently pledged, and we hope will continue to do so. One point that I think underscores Hezbollah's interest in terrorism, and I just want to focus on it again, it's one that you made, it's the use of special force. It's the dissemination of video games that have been developed by software engineers working under the aegis of Al-Manar to enmesh and to attract children into their ranks and into seeing violence as a solution to political problems. Now, I agree there shouldn't be, there should never be a one-size-fits-all in any counterterrorism approach. And here I think there's a very important point to make, which the information, the intelligence that we can gather from the websites is so enormously important. I think all terrorists throughout the world and indeed throughout history portray themselves as monolithic entities. Unfortunately, most of the time we buy that and we believe that these are rigorously led, zealously committed without any of the sorts of dissension or fissures or disputes or fractiousness that exists in other political entities or even other bureaucratic organizations. Why we buy into this myth is beyond me, but we often do. What we need to do much more of, I think, is identify and mine and exploit the cleavages and the differences in these groups, and especially when we find that one of these groups is cultivating or has developed a political wing, to attempt to create incentives to push that political wing further away from violence so as to isolate the military wing, and then to draw that wing, the political wing that is, into negotiations and into a resolution, and then to isolate and to influence the military wing to follow suit. And as we did with Sinn Féin and as the Provisional Irish Republican Army followed suit to create precisely that dynamic in other places throughout the world.
I'd like, well, first to extend my compliments to the chef, and I'm not sure if it's dessert or hors d'oeuvre chef. I guess it's
sous
hors d'oeuvre for the
Jerry,
for
point
book.
The microphone down.
I'd like to ask you both to drill down a bit on the counterterrorism dilemma. I absolutely agree. There's been a vacuum out there. I am aware from discussions at the Department of Defense of people really thinking about this, trying to address this. If it becomes attempting to counter those ideas out there with from a U.S. perspective, that's automatically denigrated as being U.S. imperialist propaganda. The issue of finding ways of facilitating moderate Muslims to be countering the extremist messages is a huge dilemma. I'm particularly struck, as you emphasized, Bruce, and as you showed so graphically, Gabby, this issue of the socialization to this point of view very early through the games, through these websites, and this virtual community of hatred. It's very hard to, I don't think there's any way of countering these attitudes once they're consolidated, and how we go about in at least providing other messages there seems to me an absolutely huge dilemma. And I wonder, I agree with your prescription, but I wonder if you could get kind of beneath the global statement in terms of how we actually can do that, how we actually can be countering these messages.
Well, improvising on one saying, if you can hack it, join it. There's no way we can stop terrorism presence on the Internet unless we destroy the Internet and start from the very start. And there's no way we can hack them. Al-Nida was hacked within days. Al-Nida.com was hacked within days. In July 2002, it emerged in 50 different websites. There's no way to stop the Internet used by terrorists. However, for counterterrorism, there are at least two ways that I would suggest to apply. First, this is an important information source. You can learn a lot. We spoke about mindset. We spoke about cleavages. We spoke about disputes. We spoke about potential cracks within the community. But in order to learn, and if you hear some latent criticism in my next sentences, you're right. In order to do that, it's not enough to recruit 1,000 students who studied Arabic 101. This may not do the work. You need people who can read the subtext, who know the mentality, who know the fingerprints, who can go behind the text. Just speaking the language, translating it, downloading it to a computer, and then creating statistical breakthrough, or using automatic crawlers, which is very popular now in the States. No need for people. You got crawlers. You got those programs that will download whatever information you need, crack it, download it, analyze it, and so on. That won't do the job. You need people who follow the rhetoric, who look into the mind of the people who wrote it, who will try to find the answers. And that leads me to the second answer. Counterterrorism starts with not leaving the arena open for the other side. Bruce mentioned it, and I describe it in my book. The internet is the tool of the next generation, of the West, of the East, of the religious, of the non-religious, of the terrorists and the victims. The future terrorists are linking themselves to the internet. If you want to fight for the minds, for the souls, and prevent them, you should go into the arena, present your arguments, and in a way that fits the mentality of those people. So you have to learn the mentality, you have to learn the way they think, and you have to give convincing answers on that arena too.
Well, one, you know, the first step is to reverse what seems to be a resource-constrained environment, at least to my knowledge, but I'm not very good at putting on green eye shades and pouring through budget lines, but at least to my knowledge that there's no specific budget line or deliberate allocation that goes to countering terrorist and jihadi propaganda and use of the internet. I think, as you pointed out in your question, that DOD is certainly paying much more attention to this, but this isn't only, and perhaps it's not even certainly not exclusively, a military responsibility. It's one, I think, that has to reach into the highest levels of public diplomacy.
QDRs, you know, there's a one-third increase for psychological
right.
Well,
I think like everything in the war on terrorism, it has to be a synergy between the military side and also the civil side. And here, I think, is where we're still fighting this struggle with one hand tied behind our back. It's not as if that this sort of counter-propaganda is completely alien or completely new to us. It was one of, I think, the most important and decisive factors in the winning of the Cold War. But then we had a separate agency, the United States Information Agency, that was properly resourced and properly staffed and whose sole mission was to fight this war of ideas. And I think as long as we relegate this type of approach to just an office in a larger department, we'll always be behind our adversaries. And here I think it's a matter, firstly, not just of substance, of getting it right, even as the increase in the QDR would say, psychological operations. It's not just of knowing the audiences we want to communicate with, which to date, too, has been somewhat problematic, but it's also an issue of numbers. It's countering, just as I said earlier, the ubiquity of these sites, and as I also described, building capacity amongst allies, not just in the stereotypical or traditional counterterrorism ways, but also for the reasons you pointed out, because our message often taints whoever is associated with it, but building up the ability of our allies and of moderates to have websites that specifically counter this rather than the very laissez-faire approach that exists today.
But before we lose the thread on this one. The question is who's going to fill that space from, if you like, the other side, the good guy side. And it seems to me that from what I've heard, the question is whether moderate Muslims, people of nonviolent views within the Ummah, are at all effective or can be encouraged to be effective in using this form of communication for their own outreach, and I think that's a question. I mean, we can put money into our own activities through government funding, but that means we probably are not the most effective voice. We should be a voice to be sure, but it seems to me whether within the Muslim world we can encourage voices who are opposed to the use of violence, that's an interesting challenge for us.
Bruce Gregory, Public Diplomacy Institute at George Washington University. First, I second the compliments on a persuasive presentation. My question also goes to the implications. Professor Joseph Nye talks persuasively about a paradox of plenty, in which he's basically saying that attention is the scarce resource, not information. And I guess I'd ask you to talk a little more concretely and operationally about what the U.S. government should do in this environment. If you were advising Karen Hughes this afternoon of the Department of Defense, what are the two or three things operationally you would suggest be done? Should the U.S. government be contracting with the private sector to develop video games, for example, that would promote certain value sets? What other things would you recommend?
Well, I didn't go that far, I must admit. Sometimes the role of a scientist is to diagnose the problem and let professionals from other areas find the solutions. But I think one point which is being missed here is that one of the challenges for modern democracies are not only to challenge terrorists on the internet, but to challenge the counterterrorism measures applied to the net by counterterrorism agencies. I'm not sure that we are all aware of the measures applied to the net and the prices that democracies are paying and will pay. Let me remind you that we all rely, even in the war on the internet, on the post 9/11 Patriot Act. The Patriot Act was designed and adopted during a time of trauma, of psychological trauma. I think it's now time to re-examine Patriot Act, especially when it applies to the internet, and see if we accept it all, if we have to modify it, and we have to get the public support for it. This is one additional price that terrorism may add to the damages caused to modern societies, Western societies, and liberal democracies, because some of the measures applied to the net that we are not aware of, some of them I describe in my book, are adding additional price, an undesired price, to the prices that we pay for terrorism in many ways. And just, and I let Bruce reply, but just to give you one example, and this is to get public approval of the measures for the counterterrorism. When you go to an airport, you're being harassed, all of you. You have to undress, you have to take your shoes off, you lose time, people are looking into your private belongings, but you are willing to do it because this is the deal between you and the counterterrorism agencies. You harass me, but you protect me. But I know quite well who is entitled to what, to do what. Who is the person? What can he do, or she? For how long? And how far can they go? How about the net? Do we know what is being done? Do you know what is being done to your emails in the name of fighting terrorism? Who's allowed to search the traffic on the net? What kind of information is being downloaded? Who has access to that? Do we have any public agreement? I think we can get some public agreement. But right now, it's not being discussed. So what I'm suggesting is one of the practical implications is not only how do we fight better, but also to examine what are the prices that liberal societies are willing to pay for the fight on terrorism on the net. This is one of the starting points that we have to start with. Otherwise, we may add, as I said, to the prices of terrorism, a very heavy price in the terms of the damage to our liberal societies.
Well, to be effective, I wouldn't only have to have the ear of Karen Hughes, but also of the White House and also of Senators Frist and Reid and of the House as well, because, of course, it was the Congress more than a decade ago that decided after the Cold War to do away with the United States Information Agency. But it's really the creation and the resourcing of a separate institution whose mission would be to accomplish these enormously important public diplomacy and public diplomacy goals and the war of minds and ideas. Within that, too, not just teams as now exist that pay attention to television or satellite television or radio or the press, but that also would be dedicated specifically and deliberately to countering messages on the internet. And here, I think you see this enormous gap and enormous vacuum, and Gabi again flagged it. Think back to September when the news of the voice of the caliphate, al-Qaeda's TV news station, was reported. What happened? I mean, that was it. It was reported and nothing else. And al-Qaeda, therefore, had this platform that was now being promulgated throughout the world, so even more people knew about it, where in a very clever mix, as all propaganda is, of fact and fiction, though they discussed Hurricane Katrina and relished the opportunity to once again condemn the United States government for the administration for various transgressions. They talked about Iraq, and we just let them do it. There was absolutely no pushback. And think of how differently, to endorse the way political campaigns have come to be conducted in the United States, but just compare that. When we're so effective in a domestic context, when a message is communicated that we either object to or that has to be drowned out, were very effective in, firstly, drowning out that message or else channeling the discussion away from that message to a topic that's more amenable or more appealing to us. And we're very good when we do this at a political level, but it seems in countering terrorism we've just forgotten all of those skills and we just give our opponents an open field. We let a voice of the caliphate be set up but then do absolutely nothing to counter it. And that's the problem. And it's got to be described. It has to come not just from the and also Ambassador Solomon, it has to come not just from the United States but from our allies, friends, and from moderates, but they need guidance. They need assistance. And we certainly have that kind of expertise to help them with a multiplicity of websites, not just one website, websites that not only are governmental ones, but of moderate Islamic institutions like Al-Azhar, for example, or of NGOs, and to increase the number and to actively attempt to counter specifically the message of the jihadis rather than let them disseminate it and let it just hang there so other people can hear it and seize on it.
Hello, I'm Allison Talbot-Durland. I had the pleasure of working with Dr. Weimann and helping him with some research on this book. And since working with him, I've followed the news. And I have a question. I often hear of a new group, unheard of before, that's committed this act or has this website. And my question is, are these groups that you had heard of before, you had already found them, and it's just coming to the public eye? Or secondly, if they are new groups, does this mean that anyone can come up with a name, create a website, and be a group, which is now a new force that we are to reckon with? Another question is along the Patriot Act, and looking into it and in reading the book, you can see the liberties that are being lost, and in coming up with a debate of what and how, if any, to continue with the Patriot Act, how easy is it to quantify the positive that it's doing because you're trying to quantify something that's not happened, something that's been prevented, and all of this, or a lot of it, is happening on the internet, which itself is a nebulous arena. Thank you.
There are thousands of websites in our archive, close to 5,000 right now, but there are many more that we don't study. Why not? Because I would say there are three circles of websites related to terrorism. The first one, the central one, are the official websites of terrorist organizations. I know it sounds crazy to have an official website of a terrorist organization, but they do. And it's very clear that these are the official websites. They maintain them, they keep them, they move them. If they are hacked, they will notify all their followers, including us, where to find them in chat rooms and forums. Then we have the second circle, which is the circle of supporters, sympathizers, and so on. Now, this circle is very often used by the terrorist organization to post messages to. Al-Qaeda did it very often, including the first announcement, first formal announcement, taking responsibility for the 9/11 attacks, was done on the net and in a chat room, actually in a forum, of the supporters of Al-Qaeda, not in an official website. And then we have the third circle, but that I would say belongs to those, half-crazies, lunatics, and so on, that are not really seriously terrorists. They like to present themselves as such. Now, how would you know? How do you know which one is who? Who is a terrorist organization? Who belongs? Who doesn't? Well, my answer is simple. When you live in a neighborhood for a long time, you know your neighbors. You know how they speak. You know when they wake up. You know when they fight. You know the language they use, you know what they eat, and you know how they dress up. My research assistants are living, some of them for years, in the same neighborhoods. Dark neighborhoods, black neighborhoods, scary neighborhoods, but they know the neighbors. And in order to know them, as I said before, it's not enough to learn, I don't know, Spanish 101, Chechen 101, Arabic 101. You have to know them, the mentality, you have to know the fingerprints. You have to know, is this really Abu Musab al-Zarqawi or somebody imitating him? Is it really the Jordanian type of Arabic being used because he's a Jordanian, even if he writes in an Arabic, in an Iraqi website? Do we have the any mistakes done when quoting religious sources that will indicate the authenticity of the website? So that's the first. That's my answer to the first question. There are new groups. We are following them. Sometimes they are the same groups reappearing in new names. Sometimes there are coalitions like the one emerging now in Iraq of many websites. And one has to realize, very interesting, the negotiation between Musaba Zarqawi and Al-Qaeda. Zarqawi was not an Al-Qaeda person. He negotiated his ambassadorship, excuse me, the profession he used, the term he used. He wanted to become the ambassador in Iraq. So he was sending messages to Al-Qaeda on the net. You can read them. And Al-Qaeda and Bin Laden responded. And there was a negotiation. All was done on the net. And he was acknowledged as the former leader of Al-Qaeda. The next move, which is being done today, and since you're going to Iraq, I think you will witness it there, from the people there, is that some of the groups there on the insurgents are now joining under the same umbrella of the Shura Mujahideen, under the leadership of Musaba Zarqawi. Again, all of this is being done on the net, including the negotiation, the announcement, the formal announcement, and so on. Finally, the last question, very shortly, very briefly, about the Patriot Act. I think the first thing to do is to describe the measures, I mean, not in detail, but at least what are the measures that are applied to the net to gain some public, at least some discussion about it, and to state the limits. Who is allowed to do what in the name of fighting terrorism on the net? The way we did it in so many other arenas, we should apply it to the internet.
I'm Ali Ayoub, not affiliated at the moment, a recent law graduate. I have a couple of comments and then a question. Firstly, it does seem that there might well be an advantage to have these websites out there because it means the information's in the open and that's been identified. So perhaps any legislation or any ideas there might be to remove the most offensive sites or sites that do seem to train possible future candidates. Maybe the best method of dealing with this is not by removing them, so they might go underground and splinter and find other methods of dispelling this information. Perhaps it's in fact one of our greatest advantages that it is out there, so one can study it and understand, and perhaps even join these chat forums and engage the people who might in fact be swayed, because why else have a forum if people were to already decide that that's what they want to do? Why discuss any ideas? So that seems to be, in fact, encouraging, while the images that were shown were, of course, incredibly disturbing. I guess that's one thing to look at. Next, regarding the war for hearts and minds, I think that it is important to realize, just as was mentioned earlier, that the means of information that's been given to these other maybe moderates or people that could well find these other sites or organizations to be appealing, perhaps it's important to realize or to identify what sources of information they're looking at. If, in fact, the main source is the internet and we don't have something to counter the information that's found on the internet, perhaps that should be a number one priority for us to put information out there. Now, I realize video games might not appeal to all, but it is important to realize that it's the younger generations, even within this country, who are becoming more radicalized because they feel that their hearts and minds aren't being looked at and addressed, and in fact they're feeling victimized by this quote-unquote war on terror. They're just kids and they don't know better. I mean, I don't know how one would organize such a video game, be it, you know, I mean, you might have sports stars or other people who act as leaders who might be from a similar background to themselves. But in fact, to leave this unexploited vacuum alone, I think is incredibly dangerous. Now, I quite liked the term that you came up with earlier, actually, the narrowcasting. It seems even better that, in fact, segments of populations have been identified for us that need to be identified as possible future groups or people who might be interested in joining up. So perhaps the internet's in fact a great resource for ourselves as well to identify where we need to look to next to engage. And now the question, what would the suggestion be? I know there was the question of how quote-unquote moderate Muslims could help in this particular, I'm very wary of using the word war on terror, I don't know, I just don't like that sort of concept, but how would it be suggested that they be identified as a group to help counter these atrocious acts that have been happening and that, in fact, a majority of the Muslim world find very repulsive indeed. Thank you.
identifying them is I don't know if it's a problem. I think part of the issue is more that we just don't understand the audiences that we need to, and I'm underscoring audiences rather than the audience. It's often seen as an audience, that we don't understand the demographics and the gradations and the nuances between the audiences. But, and this is just on the internet, I think, but in a way, since there hasn't been any effective effort, that it's an untapped resource. I almost think that you have to dig the well, and then the horses will come to it and drink out of it, in essence. But if there's no well, they're not going to come. I mean, it goes beyond that. I think it also is the recognition that you may have to tailor your message to certain audiences and certain communities. You can only know that not through conjecture and not through guesswork, but through focus groups and through detailed study. And it also involves getting away from the idea that we can sell America, or that we have to see, that we can only see this issue through our own eyes, that we really have to build it on a foundation of understanding the audience whom we're trying to, the audiences whom we're trying to communicate. And again, that's part of, I think, a massive effort that has to be, I think it's too late to undertake that and then create the websites and then to put these resources. It has to really unfold symbiotically.
In communication studies, there's an area called reception studies, looking at the audiences, subgroups, and trying to understand the motivation, the uses and gratifications in using the media or the medium, the specific content. It applies to soap opera, to reality TV, and to internet websites among terrorists. There are audiences. Now, as you said, we should study the audiences, the motives. What are they getting from the content? What are they looking for? Are they finding it? There are many indicators that the internet became a very powerful tool for terrorists in terms of the impact it has on the audiences, on sub-audiences. And we know the audiences. How do we know it? And I try to give some indicators of success in my book. The indicators of success are not the numerators on the websites, though you'll find that some terrorist websites has a propaganda tool called numerator. How many people visited our website? Inflated by terrorists themselves. So don't look at that indicator. The indicators are, first of all, the growth and expansion in number and presence of terrorist websites. It clearly works for them, otherwise they won't do it. Second, testimonies of terrorists. And we use several cases where you quotes from terrorists who argue that they find it very fruitful, very powerful. Third, terrorists themselves, who are, as you said, you testified in several cases, who were found and brought to trial, and the material presented there showed how they were recruited using the net, by the net, by communication on the net. So we have different sources pointing to the type of audiences that are affected. And maybe we should focus on who are they, why are they looking at the internet, what are they looking for, and trying to provide another answer to the same motive, to the same uses and gratifications sought by those audiences.
It's John Solomon in a relationship. But I'm a master's student at Johns Hopkins University, and I've been studying the impacts of the change in technology on society. One of the things I've noticed, I haven't read your book yet, but we keep talking about capabilities, and we keep talking about how they're early adopters. Is your argument really that they are early adopters of technology, or that we are just late to realize it? Because I would argue that really, they have not tapped into the potential of the internet and the web and communications yet. I mean, if you look at our own society and the way we use BlackBerries, the way we use Friendsters, MySpace, all these technologies that, you know, if we were just to look into Silicon Valley at what's coming out next and look to our own private companies, industries, that's really what's coming next, and that's what we're all using today, and I don't even think that they've tapped into that. I mean, if you look at terrorists in Iraq, I mean, what if they all had BlackBerries, you know? I mean, where they can pull up satellite images and text message, and I know that they've started to do that. I mean, I think it's really scary to even look at what is to come, and I think as a possible solution, we need to look at what we're using today and what our society, how we've benefited from technology as a real indicator of what's to come. And I just appreciate you commenting on that.
Thank you. You use the term early adopters, which is taken from the tradition of diffusion of innovation studies. And I wouldn't label them as early adopters, certainly not as the innovators. I think they just follow technology that is out there, that is very useful for them, easily accessed, and they can enjoy all the advantages that I described. They certainly didn't invent anything. They do not promote the internet. They do not innovate anything. They just learn very fast, and it's very easy to learn very fast. Most of the children now, high school kids, will know how to use the internet, how to post a website, how to update it, and so on. Nevertheless, there's one topic that we didn't mention, and your question leads us there. I wrote a research report about it, cyber terrorism, how real is the threat? We didn't discuss it, but terrorists may use the internet not only as an instrument, but also as a target. And this is a scary idea, because you don't have to kidnap planes if you can damage the control system. You can drive trains into each other if you damage the control system, the computerized. We are all our lives, from economy to banking to transportation, infrastructure, is all dominated by computers. Terrorists may attack. The next 9/11 attack may be not using planes or bombs or explosive materials, but using the net. So far, they have not been doing it. And one of the arguments in my research report was that for the time being, they enjoy using the internet more than attacking it. But who knows? And if I look out, I would say that the gathering cloud, the dark cloud out there, still on the horizon, is cyber terrorism. And we have to defend ourselves against that too. Now, that again brings me to the issue of what are the prices that we will pay for cyber terrorism. Because in order to defend our websites, our infrastructure, we may block access. And some websites are already removed from the net or are blocked from the public. The argument is we are fighting terrorism. And again, we have to examine how far we're willing to go in the war on terrorism when victimizing our free access to terrorist websites. So again, back to your answer, they are not the innovators, but they certainly learn fast the innovations, they adopt it. And we should be one step ahead, even if you look at the threat of cyber terrorism.
Good morning. My name is Ken Donnell. I work in the Office of Research in the International Broadcasting Bureau. And my responsibilities are audience research in South and Central Asia. And I'm also the point person for internet research. I have a question directed primarily at Mr. Hoffman. We have a research program being launched now to develop increased access to the internet users in four countries, and it's a pilot program. And we're proceeding pretty much along the lines that I think you would hope we would be proceeding. But we are undergoing, we have pressure from above, because the people with fiduciary responsibility for the broadcasting activities are only interested in one thing, and that is the cost per audience person reached. So then that biases the entire venture in favor of the mass media, which are per person or per audience member less expensive than the internet. And I would appreciate any thoughts you would have on how do we address that issue in our organization.
Gosh, that's, well, firstly, I applaud the efforts of your office, and I think that's great. I mean, this is exactly the type of cutting-edge approach we need, belated, but nonetheless important to do, and also not to base this on conjecture, but to base this on empirical evidence. But I think, you know, with the internet, you're often talking about, you know, it's a question of how long is a piece of string, in essence. As I said earlier, I don't think you can really, and I know many counterterrorism specialists will say, you can't identify a cause and effect that information was on the internet and this person became radicalized and became a terrorist. Right, exactly. But at the same time, though, it seems with increasing frequency that the internet has played an enormous role, at least in political radicalization and then even in introducing some theological dimension to it, so it's enormously difficult to measure. But again, it goes to my point that
we still don't know. I don't think we have a good enough idea, and I don't know how you measure this. People who are not getting their news from the established traditional mass media but are getting their news from the internet. Anecdotally, just from interviews I've done, people who are radicalized, I mean, whether it's in Indonesia or in South Asia or the Middle East, people are already radicalized. I mean, they just look at, you know, Al Jazeera, they especially look at Al-Hurra, it's just sellouts. I mean, they said, you know, we're not going to watch that. We will look at our own media, and those are the people. I don't know how you measure how many are there, but that's the people we have to reach.
Well, we addressed that question with our national survey. We ask people, mm-hmm. where do you get your news? And then try to make some steps of analytic generalization from that.
And that isn't justification enough for the importance of directing messages over the internet?
No, sir.
Is it because most people say they're not getting their information from the internet? Not enough. But
the cost per user is totally
exactly, and that's my point about the one size fits all, that in the main we're preventing moderates from becoming radicals. Great, that's important. But the key is these people that may cost more per person to reach, but they're the ones that are further along in this process of radicalization, are certainly more likely than the moderates, or at least are closer to the point of picking up a gun or making a bomb. And that's why, you know, penny wise, pound foolish.
And also I'd ask the question of whether your surveys really reach some of these audiences who are less out there and accessible to survey researchers.
Well, and you know, and there's another dimension too I found, is that in places, let's say like Indonesia, I mean, the people who are using the internet are not the ordinary jihadi, you know, from the countryside, who was uneducated and whose education maybe have received in a peasant run and just knows the Quran and that's all. But we often can't measure and discount that the enormous standing that these people that do have this technological savvy, that because they have access to the internet and because they tell their followers that they're getting their information there, that it has this veracity that, again, may be divorced from reality, but just their literacy and just their technological abilities is often a knock-on effect. You don't know how many people that they're in turn communicating with. And that was one of my fears, is that you have these sort of opinion shapers and leaders that is one or two handful of individuals, basically, but who are reaching a much wider audience and who even enhance their credibility because they can say, I'm getting this from the internet, and that sort of awes their less sophisticated audience.
I think we have time for one more.
My name is Mary Mullen. I work with the Bosnia Support Committee. I had spoken about this to Mr. Hoffman one time before. Before we went into the war in Iraq, there were people marching, just the general populace, all over the world, Africa, Latin America, islands, Europe, everywhere they were marching against the war. And I think the political decisions that are fighting terrorism are very important as well. And our government was telling us at that time that when we went into Iraq, they were going to drop their weapons and we were going to go in very easily, when, in fact, the whole world was marching against the United States going into the war. And these were just general populace. And the general populace now, I know, in my experience, says that, you know, they tolerate the insurgents in Iraq because they say that the United States should never have gone in anyway. And it also the decisions made, for instance, with Israel, when they use these bulldozers and use collective punishment, that's a decision that can cause a general populace to just accept or do nothing or just tolerate insurgency or this terrorism. And I was wondering, am I right? Does the fact that the general populace tolerates terrorism at certain times give encouragement to the terrorists? Does it, going in as we did to Iraq, did that give Saddam Hussein confidence? Does it give the insurgents confidence knowing that the general populace in many countries will, for instance, in Spain, they overthrew their own government because their government was supporting the United States. I don't know if I'm asking a clear question. I know I just would like some response to this from either one on the panel.
I'll let you answer, but just one remark. The centrality of Iraq in internet propaganda of terrorist organizations is very clear. Nevertheless, one should not mix the centrality of an issue on a propaganda level with the motives motivating the terrorists. Most of those terrorist organizations on the web, even those that are using the Iraqi issue, the Chechens, for example, or the one that I, Lashkar Toiba, were there long before the war in Iraq. Some of them are changing the directions. Bin Laden, before September 11, never referred, not even in a single word, to Israel and Palestine. It was not important for him. There was no mention of the Israeli issue, Palestinian issue, in Bin Laden's propaganda prior to September 11. So one has to realize that they switch languages, arguments, symbols, tactics, in terms of the propaganda level, very quickly. And they can fit them into the climate of opinion in the world media, in the target populations, and so on. Lashkar HaToiba became very anti-American only recently, when it became more popular. Nevertheless, the motives that are there for the terrorists will not disappear. And this is maybe a speculation, but I would argue that even if the presence, the American presence in Iraq will be terminated, terrorism will not be diminished. Even those terrorists that are now focusing on Iraq will find other motives, because they did long before the Iraqi issue was there. So one should realize there are many motives for terrorism, ethnic, religious, social, political, ideological, and so on. The rhetoric sometimes camouflage or distorts the real motives. So we have to be very careful. The centrality of Iraq doesn't mean that Iraq is central cause of modern terrorism. It's a central cause of modern terrorist rhetoric.
Well, I think your point raises another dimension of terrorist use of the internet that's particularly, I think, insidious and corrosive, is that to one extent it enables them to believe their own propaganda with perhaps a greater conviction than they might otherwise, because they have many more acolytes. They don't have to necessarily have active members of the terrorist organization, but commentators, propagandists, whether they're skilled ones or amateur ones, that are constantly advancing through chat forums, through bulletin boards, through discussion sites, arguments that favor the terrorists. I mean, for example, we can debate in Washington or in the political science departments of universities what really accounted for the change of mood in the Spanish electorate in March 2004. Whether it was because the incumbent government mischaracterized the attacks on the Atocha rail station as coming from the Basque separatist group ETA, and as some people allege, that they misled or they lied to the public, and that resulted in a backlash that removed them from office, or whether it's, as the terrorists argue, very convincingly in their own propaganda. Certainly, if you're going to cherry-pick facts to support an argument, that's not difficult to do rather than debate it objectively and empirically. And they rather point to the fact that terrorism works, that terrorism succeeds, which I think is something that really is borne out in Gabi's book, which makes the Internet so powerful, is that it's creating the image for decades at least. One could argue, too, for centuries, governments and others have argued terrorism doesn't work, that it's not successful in delivering to terrorists at least their long-term ultimate objectives. But through the Internet and the vast audiences that terrorists are able to reach, they're not only have a capacity, as Gabi describes in his book, to engage in information laundering, but to rally other people to say, look, we are effective, to make the claim we changed a government in a Western European democracy, and this is what terrorism doesn't matter if it's false. Propaganda doesn't have to be true to be believed. But that's precisely their effectiveness, and why I think this is such a dangerous threat that we have to devote more attention to countering. I go back to my earlier point, the use of, as we've engaged in the war on terrorism, that's being military dominated, not inappropriately, where we've sought to kill and capture terrorists, to break the back, to diminish al-Qaeda and our enemies' abilities to attack us again physically, is absolutely critical, is absolutely important. But I think everything that we've discussed this morning shows that it's no less critical and no less important to break the cycle of the resonance of the terrorist message that continues to resonate 4.5 years into the war, that facilitates their continued recruitment, which seems clear, that there's already, as I pointed out, a new generation of terrorists who have been radicalized and who have been being trained, but yet also that facilitates these terrorist groups' regeneration by their ability to look even the generation beyond the next and use information on all levels to inculcate and to instill in the youth of the world, especially in countries that we know demographically are already experiencing an enormous youth bulge, where a majority of their populace is already under 17, and a problem that's just become more common and greater in 2020. This is really why I think countering these messages on the internet is so enormously important. Now, obviously, putting in terrorists to jail or removing them from circulation is absolutely critical. But if this isn't to turn into the long war that the Quadrennial Defense Review describes, this other element of breaking these cycles of the three R's, as it were, is just as critical.
Well, I want to thank our two presenters and our audience. This has been exceptionally rich morning.